Yesterday in the 8th chapter, at the end, we learned about the path of light and the path of darkness as described by Sri Krishna, where he says that the path of darkness is any kind of action which is done without surrender to him, because it keeps you under Maya, and Maya is referred to as darkness. And any thing that you do, any practice that you follow where you're surrendering to him, that's the path of light, because if you surrender to him through his grace, you can go beyond Maya and you can attain divine status. In the 9th chapter, in the beginning, Sri Krishna says what seems like a contradictory statement, but it's in fact a very concise description of a divine situation. Maya tatmidam sarvam jagadavyaktamurtina matsahani sarvabhutani nachaham teshvavasthita. I'll come to exactly what he's saying in a minute. The very next verse says, nacha matsthani bhutani. And in the 7th chapter, there was a verse where he said, matta eveti tan vidhi natvaham teshu te mai. So in all of these statements, in these shlokas, he's saying what appears to be something contradictory. On one hand, he's saying, all of this is me. So there's a philosophy or a way of explaining the situation between God and the souls and the world, which is called Advaita. It means only one, no other. It means only God, nothing else. And there's another way of explaining things, which is Dvaita, meaning that, oh, there's a difference between God and the souls. There's a difference between God and the world. And both types of statements are found in all of our scriptures, not only in the Gita. But here in this verse he's saying, Maya tatamidam sarvam jagadavyaktamurtina. I have become the form of this world. Then he says, all the souls are established in me. But then he says, the souls are not in me. And he previously said, I am in the souls. And he also says, but I am not in the souls. He says all of these things within a couple of verses. It sounds confusing, but when I explain it to you, it'll make good sense and you can remember. It's actually a good reconciled understanding of this Dvaita and Advaita. Advaita meaning oneness, there's only God, there's nothing else. And Dvaita, no, there's a difference. God is God and there are some other things that exist other than God. In the Vedas, there are three existences described. Bhokta bhogyam preritaram cha matva sarvam proktam trividham brahma me tat. Taittiriya Upanishad refers to God, the souls, and Maya, three things that exist. At other places in the Vedas, it talks about two existences. Dva, Suparna, Sayuja, Sakaya, Samanam, Riksham, Parikasvajate, Ityadi. Shvetashvatara Upanishad, and this same mantra comes in several Upanishads. It means that there's God and there's the souls. Here is leaving out Maya. Then there are other mantras like Ekameva Dvitiyam Brahma Neha Nanasti Kinchana Chandogya Upanishad. There is only God and there's nothing else that exists. So you see in the Upanishads it also seems like there are contradictions. In some places there's only God, that statement is said. In other places, no, there's God and there's souls. And in other places, there's God, there's souls, and there's Maya. So how do we reconcile this? We can just understand from what point of view these different statements are being made. The fact is that a tattva cannot cease to exist. A tattva means an essentially existing thing. Just like in science we know, it's a law that energy cannot be created or destroyed. Because it's a tattva. You can't create or destroy it. It exists.
Yeah, yeah.
If it exists, it can't cease to exist. It can't disappear. Then why do we sometimes say there are three tattva, and sometimes we say there are two, and sometimes we say there are one? These three things do exist. Okay, souls exist, God exists, and the material energy we call Maya exists. At some places the Vedas say there are only two things, because Maya is jara. I talked about that a couple of days ago. Maya is a lifeless, mindless energy. So sometimes the Vedas just leave that out and talk about God and the souls, who are both chetan, they're both alive. And sometimes the Vedas talk about there only being God. Here Krishna's put all of this together in one verse. First understand the oneness part. When there are souls, and there is a material energy, and there is God, then why would Krishna say, no, 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 it's all me, there's nothing other than me? Because physically speaking, nothing is separate from him. Take the world, first of all. When God permeates every particle of this world, then is it wrong to say this microphone is God? He is in every single molecule, every particle, every subparticle, he's there. It's like if you have a block of ice, you can say that just like the ice is permeated by water, right? It's made of water. The water itself took the form of the ice. Something like that, God himself has taken the form of this world. But Maya still exists as a power of God, which is a material energy, but it exists upon the base of God, and God permeates Maya. So Maya is totally dependent on God. It cannot exist or function without God. And it doesn't exist outside of God. It's within God, physically within God. So when God creates the universe, you can say it's like, let's say if you make an ice sculpture out of water that has food coloring in it. So when you see the sculpture, let's say you put red food coloring and you made a sculpture of an apple or something. So when you look at it, what do you see? You see the red. You don't see the pure, clear, original state of the water, which is there. You just see the red. And it's the water itself which has taken the form of the apple, but you just see the red. Something like that, it's God himself who has taken the form of this universe, but just like the food coloring in the water, Maya's there. And we only see the Maya. It's an analogy, it's not a perfect analogy, but it helps us to try to understand how God is here everywhere, but we only see the Maya. But there's no physical separation between God and Maya. God permeates every particle. So from that point of view, you can say, God is everything. God has become everything. And same thing with the souls. God permeates our soul as well. He is within us. And he's giving life to us. So we are also perfectly dependent upon him for our existence. So from that point of view, there's no separation between soul and God. Physically, he permeates us. There's no separation between God and the world. Physically, he's permeating the world. And you can turn it around also and say the world, just like I said, he's within the world. Well, the world is within him also. Because he's unlimited, so could anything exist outside of him? No. He's holding the whole universe within himself. And all of the souls also exist within him. If he's everywhere, we exist at one point, right? And God is everywhere, so we're also within him. I'm just telling you in brief, this is the oneness part. God is in us, we're in him. God is in the world is in him. From a physical point of view, there's no separation between God and the souls and God and the world. And from a dependency point of view, there's no separation because Maya is fully dependent on God and the souls are fully dependent on God for their life. Now let's look at the other side. Because in this verse of the Gita, Sri Krishna says, I am in the world and the world is in me. I am in the souls and the souls are in me. And then he turns around and says, I am not in the souls and they are not in me. I am not in the world and the world is not in me. Or I am not in Maya and Maya is not in me. This also makes perfect sense. First, take Maya. God is not in Maya and Maya is not in God. He's not speaking literally here because physically speaking, Maya is in God and God is in Maya. But from a personality and a characteristic point of view, Maya and God are very different. For one, God is Chaitan. He's alive. And the material energy has no mind. This paper has no mind. It's not alive. Material energy is jada. So, God's divine qualities are not manifested in Maya. Therefore, God is, that's why he's saying kind of in a codified way, I'm not in Maya. It means my divine qualities are not manifested in Maya. Even though he's omnipresent, kind of like, see, this part of you is conscious. If you tap your thumb, you can feel it. But the nail that grows out of your thumb, you can cut it and you don't feel anything. So something jada is growing out of something chetan. Something lifeless and feelingless is growing out of something with feeling and with life. Something like that, this maya, has come out of God. Like the hair on our head. Our head we can feel, but you cut your hair, you don't feel pain. Something like that, maya is just existing on the base of God, but doesn't have God's divine qualities. But it's still an eternal existence. So from this point of view, Krishna says, I'm not in Maya. And Maya's not in me means he's not affected. Even though he's permeating Maya, the Mayic qualities, like there's sattva, raj, tam, the good quality, normal quality, bad quality, those material qualities are not found in God. He is beyond material qualities. So even though he's in the world and the world is in him, he's not affected by the material qualities or the material energy. Excuse me. It also means when you look at the souls, see, he says, I am not in the souls. Well, physically speaking, that's not correct. He is in the souls. And why is he saying he's not in the souls? Because he's not controlling us. He's within us, he gives life to us, but he does not control our actions. So that's why he's saying, I'm not in the souls. It means that he's there, but he's there in a, he's just there to observe. He's not directing our each and every motion. And the other way, the souls are not in me. That's also not physically true. We are in him, yet he's saying the souls are not in me. It means that we also lack some godly qualities. This is the end of this technical description, but this part is the most important to understand. He has three powers. Okay, Maya is one, the material potency. The souls are a second power. And his third power is called Yogamaya. That's his personal divine power, which makes all the impossibles possible. It's Yogamaya that makes God ever blissful. It's Yogamaya that makes God all-knowing. Through Yogamaya, God is omnipresent in the world, but unaffected by material qualities. When he says that the souls are not in me, what he means is souls are not a part of this Yogamaya power. You see, there's a term used in many scriptures, Ansh. Souls are Ansh of Bhagavan. Souls are Ansh of God. Ansh means a part of, a fraction of. So then we could ask, okay, are we a part of Yogamaya Shakti, God's personal power? Are we a part of Maya Shakti, the material power? So, we're not a part of Maya, because if we were a part of Maya, we would also be lifeless and mindless. So souls are not a part of Maya. If we were a part of Yogamaya, we would be all-knowing and all-blissful, because even a fraction of the unlimited is also unlimited. So even if we were Ansh of Yogamaya, we would have unlimited bliss, unlimited knowledge, unlimited power. We don't have those qualities within us, so it means we are not part of Yogamaya Shakti. So there's a third power which is in between the two. It's not part of Maya, it's not part of Yogamaya, it is called Jeev Shakti. Jeev means soul, and Shakti means power. So we're a part of God's soul power. All the souls in existence, of which there's an unlimited number, but a fixed number, God's never creating any new souls, there have eternally been unlimited souls in existence. They're all a part of God's Jeev Shakti, or soul power. And those souls, although they're in a way higher than Maya, because Maya's mindless and lifeless, but they're not equal to God, not in every respect. We're equal to God in this way, that we're eternal like He is, and we're alive like He is. But in terms of our knowledge and power and blissfulness, we can't compare ourselves to God at all. So now you can understand that when the Vedas are saying there's only God, there's nothing but God, they're talking from that point of view, saying that is anything separate from God? Is there anyone who exists apart from God? No. When the Vedas speak of two things, they're talking of God and soul. When they speak of three, they're also including Maya. All are correct. But technically speaking, there are three things that exist. But since the souls and Maya depend on God, sometimes we say there's only one thing that exists, God. But you should not get confused thinking that I am God. You can think of it from the point of view that God is here within me. But our personality is individual. God has His personality, which is blissful, caring, perfectly caring, perfectly gracious, perfect knowledge. That's His personality. Absolute power. And our personality, as we all know and accept, is faulty. We all have faults. So how can we say, I am God? That doesn't make sense. We can understand that God is within us and we're not separate from Him, but at the same time, we have our own personality and He has His personality. And the soul who surrenders to God can become more like God than he is now. Meaning God gives him His unlimited knowledge and His unlimited bliss, but even then he still remains as a soul with an individual personality. He doesn't become God, because if he became God, that would mean he as a soul ceased to exist, which is impossible. An existing thing cannot cease to exist. And this has been our situation since eternity. Sometimes people wonder, When was I separated from God? It never happened. Although there's, as I was saying, there's no physical separation, but we don't know God. God is not visible to our material eyes. We've never directly experienced Him. So in that way, we're separate from God. If we were one with God, if we had attained a state of divine unity with God, we would be experiencing divine bliss all the time. So the very fact that we are sometimes unhappy, or many times unhappy, it shows us that we are separate from God, at least in terms of our experience. Even if someone says, oh no, God is within, okay, that's great, that's a theoretical knowledge you have, correct. Yes, God is within. That's like saying that I have $1 million in gold coins buried beneath my floorboards, or somewhere under my house. And what do you do every day? How do you make a living? You go out begging. But I'm the richest person in my town because I have $1 million in gold coins buried under there. Well, dig it up. So just saying God is there is not enough. We have to actually experience Him. So to experience Him, we have to become surrendered to Him. This is a common theme throughout the Gita, becoming surrendered to Sri Krishna. In order to become surrendered to Him, we don't have to go anywhere because He's already here. We have to surrender our heart to Him or turn our mind towards Him. You can call that developing faith in Him or increasing your attachment in Him. These are all different words for the same thing. In this way, in a very short few verses, Sri Krishna reconciles all these apparent controversies between Dvaita and Advaita. All the explanations of the saints regarding monistic theory or dualistic theory, all of this is reconciled in these couple of shlokas of the ninth chapter. There are a couple other important ideas from the ninth chapter. I'm not covering each and every verse. I'm just giving you a couple important things to take away from this chapter, which are practical things that you can practically apply in your life. Many of us, many people, worship more than one form of God. And not just more than one form of God, because Krishna, as I explained, He does have many forms. He appears as Vishnu, He appears as Shiva, Ram, Durga, Ganeshji. He appears in uncountable divine forms. But there are also celestial gods, we call devatas. Celestial gods are not divine, like you wouldn't write God with a capital G. And it's okay to put an S on the end, plural. They are gods, there are many of them. But there are not many gods with a capital G, okay? There's only one capital G God. These material celestial beings, they're called devatas, and they live in Swarg, which I described to you briefly a couple of days ago, the celestial abodes. It's also part of Maya, and although it's a higher state of Mayic energy, you can say, more refined than the Mayic energy we have here, the matter over there is more refined, the pleasures are higher, yet it's still part of Maya, so it's imperfect, and there's no true divine happiness, even in Swarga. So the celestial gods also are a part of the Mayic energy. They're not divine forms of God. So anyone who worships them, at most, can go to Swarga. No one can attain divine God by worshipping celestial gods. So because of this, he says, ये प्यन्यदेवता भक्ता यजन्ते श्रद्धायान्विता ते पिमामेव कौन्तेय यजन्त्यविधिपूर्वकम् tells Arjun that although I'm the one giving power to these celestial gods, and those celestial gods, if they're worshipped, well, someone could go to the abode of that celestial god and enjoy. So whatever that celestial god gives is coming from me, Krishna says. They don't have anything that I don't give them. So indirectly, by worshipping them, you are worshipping me. Krishna is saying that. But, he says, yajanti avidhi purvakam. Those who worship the celestial gods do so in ignorance. And in the next verse, or in a verse in this ninth chapter, he says, te tam huktva swargalokam vishalam kshine punye martyalokam vishanti. That those who go over to Swarg, they do enjoy extensive pleasures, but then they're bound to be reborn in this world. So it means they don't get ahead spiritually. You don't gain anything spiritually by going to Swarg. You're right back where you started, right here. Our spiritual goal is to attain Supreme God. And you don't get closer to attaining God by going to Swarg. In fact, you have to come back here, get born as a human, then you could attain God. You can't attain God while you're in Swarga. So the celestial gods are like Indra, the god of rain, Agni, the god of fire, Vayu, the god of wind, the Nagara Devatas. These are all different celestial gods. There are many, many of them. You can say that they're employees of Supreme God, they're mayic powers, but they're not divine, and you can't attain the divine world by worshipping them. Sri Krishna summarizes this whole philosophy when he says, yanti deva prata devan pitrin yanti pitribrata bhutani yanti bhutejya yanti madhyajinopimam. He says, whatever you worship, that's where you'll go. If you worship celestial gods, you'll go to Swarga. If you worship Supreme God, Krishna says, if you worship Him, you'll go to His divine abode. If you worship spirits, if you worship material beings of this physical world, then you'll be reborn in this world, or you'll go to the spirit world. But there's only one way to go to the divine world, and that's by worshipping God directly, bypassing the worship of all other material beings or powers. This is a very important philosophy of the ninth chapter. Krishna uses that word ananya or ananyata at many places in the Gita. So this is part of understanding how to be ananya. When you realize that my divine goal is to attain Krishna, so then why would I worship celestial gods? It's not that we're disrespecting celestial gods, but Krishna, you see, Veda Vyasji writes in the Bhagavatam, yatha taror mulanishe chanena tripyanti tatskandha bhujo pashakha. He says that if there's a big tree and you take water and just pour it on the root, the whole tree will get the water. The trunk, the bark, the branches, the twigs, the leaves, the fruit, the flowers, everything will get the water if you just pour it on the root. But if you take the same water and sprinkle it on all the leaves, neglecting to pour it on the root, the tree is going to dry up and die. Similarly, if you just worship Shri Krishna directly, all the other celestial gods, even other forms of God, they're all satisfied and happy. Because He's the root. He's Adi Purush. So we shouldn't have the idea that, oh, if I don't worship celestial gods, I'll be disrespecting them or they'll be unhappy or something like that. Well, their boss is Krishna. They're happy if you're worshipping the boss. Okay, just do bhakti to Sri Krishna. All the celestial gods, all the material powers, they're all happy. All the divine powers are happy, let alone material powers. This is ananyata. It means exclusive devotion to only one. Keep in mind that the divine forms of God are not many. They're one, but appearing in many forms. You should never get confused thinking there are many gods. There's only one God. But that one God appears in many forms. Then Sri Krishna reveals a very important philosophy about his grace. He says, first of all, Samoham sarvabhuteshu name dveshyosti na priya. In the first line of the shloka, he says, I am samadarshi, which means I look upon all the same. I don't favor anyone, nor do I oppose anyone. I don't love anyone or hate anyone. I'm just neutral. I'm the same towards everybody. But in the second line of the verse, he says, Ye bhajanti tu mam bhaktya maite teshu chapyaham. But the one who worships me through devotion, through bhakti, I am in him and he stays in me. Again, he's using this in, being in or not being in way of talking. So what does he mean? And it seems like a contradiction as well. On one hand he's saying, I'm the same to everybody, and in the next verse he's saying, those who do devotion to him, they get some kind of special consideration. In fact, he's referring to two different types of grace. Grace is a power of God called kripa. One, you can say type of grace, one type of grace you can understand as a general grace of God. A general grace upon all the souls. In what ways do we receive that grace? For one thing, he's giving life to our soul, and he does that to everybody. Even the one who professes not to believe in him, who considers himself to be an atheist, think of the irony. That person is denying the existence of God, and the same God is within that person's soul, giving life to his soul, and it's with the power God is giving him that he's able to say, I don't believe in God. In other words, that grace is for everybody. It doesn't matter who they are, God gives life to every individual soul. That's one general grace on all the souls. Another thing he does, which you might not have considered to be his grace, but actually is a great grace upon all the souls, is that he manifests the universe. Why does he manifest the universe? Does he need the trouble of looking after this universe? Remember, I told you when the universe is dissolved, God is still there. His divine abode is still there. The saints who have attained him are still there. They're all perfectly fine, enjoying in the divine world. What possible reason would God have for manifesting this physical world? What a headache it is. Why does he do it? For those who haven't attained him yet. All of the souls are eternally apart from God. We were never separated. Since eternity, we've been in the same state we are now. We're here, but we're not experiencing God. So you can say we're separated from God. When were we separated? It never happened. It's always been like that. Had it ever happened, then you could blame God. Why did you let me get separated from you? Or why did you put me in this world when I was with you at one time? No, we were never with God. We've eternally been turned away from God. That verse I quoted from Vedas, Dvasuparna Sayuja Sakaya, it says that God is always watching you. He's waiting with open arms, waiting for you to turn around to Him, but your back is to Him. It means we don't have real faith in Him. We look towards the world for our happiness, not towards God. That's been our eternal situation. It's not God's fault, it's our fault. We're eternally turned away from Him. But many souls have attained Him. How did they attain Him? Because when He manifests the universe, He also makes spiritual knowledge available in the world. When He manifests the universe, He gives souls a human birth, allows them to be born as human, so they have the intellect that would allow them to understand such things, and then He provides the knowledge through the Vedas, through the Gita, and other such scriptures. So providing that knowledge is part of His grace upon all of the souls. Manifesting the universe, if He didn't manifest the universe, what state would we be in? We'd be dormant. When the universe is dissolved, we have nowhere to live. Our bodies dissolve, even our mind becomes dormant. So our soul just stays in a state of pending within God. What's the use of existing like that? We're totally unconscious during that time, during the dissolution of the universe. We're not free from anything. We're just in a state of pending. So in order to give us a chance to get free, a chance to attain Him, God has to manifest the universe, reactivate the material power, give us birth, provide the knowledge through the scriptures, send saints on the earth planet to explain those scriptures to us. He Himself comes on the earth planet, He takes avatar, He comes as Ram, He comes as Krishna, He comes in many forms. He's doing all of that. Why? For us. For all the souls. In addition to that, having given life to our soul, He also keeps track of all of our actions and gives us the consequences of those actions. He gives us the results of our karma. This is also a general grace on all the souls. We don't remember what we did in our last life. How could we give ourselves the consequences of our past life's actions? So God does that for us. The devotion we did in past lifetimes, God is giving us the result of that devotion by giving us that kind of inner inclination to go towards Him in this life. He's giving us that inclination, yes, but based on the devotion we did in past lifetimes. It's the outcome of that. So He's gracing us in so many ways. This is a general grace on all the souls. So that's why He says, I'm Samadarshi. I give the same grace to everybody. But there's also a special grace. If someone really accepts the teachings of what that knowledge He's providing, like this knowledge of the Gita, and they become surrendered to Him, then they get a special grace. And that special grace makes them God-realized. And then they attain His unlimited bliss and unlimited knowledge. So He says, I reside in them and they reside in me. That means that someone who's God-realized always sees God everywhere. He never feels separate from God, and God is always with him, protecting him. There's another verse from this ninth chapter. Ananyaschintayanto mam ye jana paripasate tesham nityabhiyuktanam yogakshemam vamyaham. He says, the one who is totally surrendered to me, he says, he's ananya, and his mind never leaves me for a second. His mind is always in me. So who's like that? A saint. A God-realized saint is like that. We're not like that. He says, yogakshemam vamyam. For that person, I take his 100% responsibility. The God-realized saint doesn't have to do anything anymore. God has, because he has nothing left to attain, he's fully surrendered to God. So like a newborn baby, whose mother does everything for him, God does everything for the saint. He doesn't have to worry for anything. What about us? See, we're not fully surrendered to God, so there's the two states, right? There's the general grace, where having given life to our soul, God is watching our karma and giving us the consequences. So if we're not surrendered to God, He's merely giving us the consequences of our karma. If we're surrendered to Him, we get His special grace, which gives us God realization. What about those who are in between? Well, we get a mixture. To the extent we're surrendered to God, we experience some amount, not of the actual divine bliss, but a reflection of that bliss is experienced on the devotional path. And God does make some particular exceptions for His devotees in trying to help them proceed on the path. You can say He's not just Nyayi. Nyayi means dispensing justice. Oh, you did this karma, get this result. That's how God is if you're not surrendered to Him. When you're surrendered, there are some adjustments made to help you on your spiritual path. But it depends on the degree of our surrender. So we all receive His general grace all the time. And that special grace is also available to anyone at any time, but in order to receive it, we have to open our heart and become surrendered to God. At the end of this chapter, he says, Patram pushpam phalam toyam yo me bhaktya prayacchati tadam bhaktyupahita mashnami prayatatmana. Here he's talking about devotion. In the Vedas, there's two, or you can say in all of our scriptures of Hinduism, there's two kinds of devotion described. Two kinds of bhakti. One is vaidhi bhakti, one is raga nuga bhakti. Vaidhi bhakti is according to many difficult rules and regulations that have to be followed. How to worship, what way to sit, what you have to recite, what you have to offer to God, what time of day to do it. It's very strict. Very difficult to follow. That's called Vaidhi Bhakti. Raga Nuga Bhakti focuses more on the internal feelings. How do you feel related to God? How do you love God? So this Patram Pushpam verse here, Sri Krishna is saying, offer me anything. Offer me a leaf, a flower, a fruit, even water. It doesn't matter. If you offer it with faith and love, I will appear before you and accept it. He says, Ashnami, I will eat it, if you offer it with full faith. And we have many examples in our divine history of people of all ages who faithfully offered things to God, and God had to come to that person. He doesn't just offer it, meaning He doesn't just accept it remotely. If He's going to accept something, He appears and accepts that thing. So if you truly offer something to God, you only have to do it once, because He'll appear before you and He'll be God realized. But we have to do it with full faith. Here he's saying, just whatever you offer me, offer it with faith. So this is more towards the Raga Nuga Bhakti style of devotion. He's not talking about strict regulations about how to worship Him. He says it's more important that you have faith and love for Him, and offer whatever you offer with that faith and love. This is for someone who wants God realization. Some people worship different forms of God with a desire to get some kind of material benefit or better destiny in the next life. So they have to follow all the rules and regulations of Vaidhi Bhakti. But for God realization, you can just do Raga Nuga Bhakti, because you have to surrender your mind, so you offer things with faith and love. And the last verse I'll explain to you today, he says, whatever you do, offer it all to me. Yat karoshi yadashnasi yat juhoshi dabasi yat tapasyasi kaunteya tat kurushva madarpanam. Whatever you do, here he mentions good actions, which are described in the Vedas, like doing charity, doing some rituals, doing any kind of good action. He says, whatever you do, offer it all to me. Why? Because we have to surrender our mind to Krishna, yet we also have to be physically active in the world. So one way to maintain remembrance of him is that we should think, okay, this action, Krishna, I'm offering this action to you. It's important to remember that you can't offer an action to him later on. Some people have a practice that before they go to bed at night, before they sleep, they think of Krishna and they say, everything, whatever I did today, good or bad, I offer it all to you. And no, it's too late. In order to offer an action to Krishna, at the time we're doing the action, we have to be thinking of him, and in our mind we should be doing that action to please him. Like, let's say you're eating something, then you should think, of course you want to offer it to Krishna first, and then even when you're eating it, what you should be thinking is, what you could be thinking, is, well, I have to eat this food to support my body, which you've given me, Krishna, and I know you gave me this body so that I could do devotion to you and attain you. So I need to put food in it so that I can be healthy and do more devotion to you. Or, I have to go to sleep now. I need to get some sleep so I can get up in the morning and do devotion to you. So you can offer all of your actions to him. Oh, I have to go to work? Yeah, I have to work so I can make money to get food to keep my body healthy so I can do more devotion to you. So you, in that way, you can offer all of your actions to Sri Krishna. But you have to think about him at the time of the action. Only then it's offered. Or your motivation for performing the action should be devotional. It should be a devotional motivation. Then it's considered to be offered to him. So this is the main philosophy of the ninth chapter. There's a lot more in the ninth chapter as well, but these are the points that I wanted to share with you from the ninth chapter of the Gita.